This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and the year 2016 is just around the corner, so we thought we would take a few moments to look back at the year in review. And what better way to do that than to talk with the producers of the State of Things to hear from them about their favorite segments on our program. Ordinarily, when I do this once a year, we bring the producers on, Will Michaels, and I intimidate the producers because they're not used to being on air, and I can scare them. I can really, but you actually, we hear you on the air. You're used to being on this side of the microphone, this side of the glass.
Well, not in this particular studio, but it's a little warmer in this studio than the rest of them.
It's my personality. Listen, we will take a look back now and start the whole series with you, a member of the State of Things staff, Will Michael, a producer who you also hear periodically on Morning Edition. Will, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
You are filling in as host on Morning Edition today, which is kind of interesting. So not only are you on the air this morning, but you're on the air now.
I've been awake since 4 o'clock, so as soon as I'm counting down to 1 o'clock so I can take a nap right here in your studio.
No excuses, Will. You don't make sense even when you have lots of sleep. So, okay. One of the hallmarks of the program, of course, the Monday Meat series, and you chose a few of those for your best of. What are we going to hear first?
We're going to hear from behavioral economist Dan Ariely of Duke University. One of the things that the Monday Meat does is take a look at the person's background. I mean, how did they get to where they are today? He has a fascinating story about that, actually tragic story about that. He grew up in Israel. There's a mandatory service in the military in Israel. He was burned very badly, and it informed what he did for the rest of his life.
Dan Ariely, let's listen.
I was next to a military flare. This is the magnesium flare that you would send up to the sky to light up a battlefield, for example. And I was in the place of my commanders that had quite a few of those, and one of them exploded by accident. And I was had the misfortune to being very close to it, so I got burned in about 70% of my body. Most of the upper part of my body was burned, and later on, a few minutes later, also my legs got burned, and I spent the next almost 3 years in hospital. And that really brought me to thinking about human irrationality, decision-making, and also about human misery in a very different way, and changed my focus to try and reduce human misery to the extent that I can.
Well, I want to talk about those thoughts you were having, but a lot of that was driven by the fact that you were so cut off socially, laid up in a hospital as you were, all of those friends, all of those connections that you had made on various hitchhiking trips and in these communities, you're now cut off.
Yeah. So first of all, being physically cut off is clear. So I was all of a sudden on the bed, and there was nothing I did that I've done before aside from breathing. So, you know, in the beginning I couldn't breathe by myself, but then when I could start breathing by myself, still there was nothing. I couldn't eat. I had a tube that was feeding me. I couldn't stand up, sit up. I wasn't involved in any social interactions with normal people, just with doctors and nurses, which I know are normal people, but in a different type of interaction. And I started looking at life from a slightly different perspective. I felt a little bit like an alien. You know, imagine an alien came down here and looked at us. There were a lot of things that we couldn't do. So for example, I'll give you just two kind of trivial examples. But I remember the first time I ate. So I had this tube that would feed me for about 4 months, I think. And they would feed me about 7,000 calories a day and about 30 eggs a day to try and rebuild my ability to recover. And then all of a sudden they gave me something to eat. And I wanted to eat strawberries and whipped cream. But they said whipped cream was taking too much space. I need to do something more condensed. And they wanted me to eat some hamburger. And chewing was so strange. All of a sudden, after not chewing for 4 months, I felt, what? It's disgusting. Why do we do this? All of a sudden, the idea that a tube felt so clean and efficient, and all of a sudden having to chew, and by the way, having to eat 7,000 calories by myself was an awful torture. Or another trivial example is the first time I went by myself into the bath. So usually they would take a stretcher and they would lower me to a bath with them, like a little lift fork. But the first time I would sit back into the bath myself, I had to get up. And I started thinking, how do you get out of a bath? And I couldn't remember what are the actions that you take. So after months and sometimes years of not doing something, everything seemed strange. I looked in strange ways at how people interact with each other and why people ate. And I looked in a strange way at why people do the, you know, romantic courting and everything like that. And to some degree, I still have this perspective. And I think it makes me a slightly better social scientist. So I'm still covered with scars. I still look different. You know, when people approach me and they shake my hand, it's evident that they see that my hands are badly burned and they don't know what to do. And I still feel quite separate and different from other people and society. And because of that, I think I almost never feel a part of anything. You know, I have the pain that I still have. I have the scars. I have the looks in people's eyes. And all of those keep on reminding me that I'm different. And I keep on looking at life slightly as an outsider. For all of those reasons. And I think it's professionally, it's difficult personally, but professionally I think it's very useful.
That was part of our interview with Duke University behavioral economist Dan Ariely earlier this year. I'm talking with State of Things producer Will Michaels, and that was one of his favorites from 2015. A very good hour. One of the many. We also met Dudley Flood this year. Perhaps the crowning achievement of his career was to help integrate North Carolina's public schools in the late 1960s and the early 70s. It was an impossible task, if you can imagine what he was facing at the time, but it turns out he was also driven by his upbringing, right?
He grew up in a small town, northeastern North Carolina, called Winton, North Carolina. It was home to a school from the 1800s that was founded as a charter school for African Americans living in northeastern North Carolina, but it became a regional magnet school, basically. All the best teachers were there. That he had this amazing emphasis on education growing up in Winton, North Carolina, because of that school, basically. So it wasn't necessarily surprised that he grew up to take on this task from the Department of Public Instruction in North Carolina. And one of the stories that he told us during that hour was that when he went on the road with Gene Cosby, who was white, and Gene actually died a few weeks before we had Dudley on the show, they stopped at this gas station and he picked up a round rubber ball on the end of a paddle ball, to bring all these people together, including the Black Panthers, the KKK, all these people in Hyde County where there was a boycott going on, and he used this ball as a teaching method.
Let's listen to part of an interview with Dudley Flood earlier this year.
Hyde County may be the most noted aspect of our DSEG process because it had a 1970/71 school year, a year-long boycott, which became nationwide known, national news and that sort of thing. And we were just headed there for a meeting that it'd been told ahead of time. Everybody will be here, not just the people who live here, but whenever that kind of thing happens, you tend to draw a crowd from elsewhere, and many of whom we knew, and we knew the people who were prone to lead that sort of thing. And we stopped at a little place to get a soda, and I saw this little paddle that has a rubber ball on a rubber band at the end of the paddle. And I noticed it was multicolored. One side of it was green, I think, and the other was red. And I bought that little 25-cent paddle for $1 and took the rubber ball off. And when we got to the gathering, I held that ball up and I said, "Before we begin, will you tell me what color this ball is?" They said, "Red." I said, "No, it's green." "It's red, green." And we argued a while. And I turned the ball around and said, "Now tell me what you see here." "Oh," they said, "on your side is green." I said, "Well, here's what we want to do. We want you to understand, until you shall have seen how it looks to me on my side, you can't convince me that you know what you're talking about, because this ball is going to be red on this side and green on that side to the day it dies. Now, if I'm willing to come around here and see how it looks to you, and you're willing to come around here and look how it looks to me, then we can reconcile that." And that little episode helped us in many, many instances, that very little ball, to get people to see that there are two sides to practically everything.
Well, let me stop just there, because Hyde County was perhaps your hardest case. You talked about that year-long boycott. We should point out that there was resistance in African-American communities to this as well, right?
That's really where the resistance began. There was an African-American school, and like in most communities, it was the center of the community. It turns out that this particular school was going to be changed in a dramatic way, and the community didn't want it to be changed in a dramatic way. They were going to be bused up to Madam Mesquite. They were down in Swan Quarter. And they wanted to maintain a high school presence there. Well, over time, we were able to help them to understand that it may not be in your best interest just to hang on to that one thing. We'll maintain a presence, not necessarily a high school presence. And here's some dimensions of that you can retain and so on and so forth. But the interesting thing about a situation like that is that it reaches a point of polarization at some point. And then your choice is not so much to understand the issue, it's whose side are you going to be on? You're going to be with us or you're going to be against us? And even going in to intervene or help intervene in a situation like that, you're invited to be a part of the problem, really. The first thing, Gene being white, was perceived as you ought to take the white community's part. I being black was perceived as you ought to take the black community's part, and your failing to do so would get you called some names that were not particularly flattering. If you don't have a thick enough skin to weather that, if you're going to try to retaliate to that, you're going to be a part of the problem. But if you understand, that's a very logical reaction. People say, you know, you ought to understand this. You live with us. You're one of us. Why don't you understand this? The problem is I really do understand it more than you do. Mm-hmm. And I have to be very subtle about that, but I have to operate on what I know, not what you would like me to think. And I have to recommend something here which is in the best interest of children. That's who we're here for. We're not here for you. Nobody has a right to be at school except children. Everybody else is there by privilege. And you can't say that all the time, but you have to know that and you have to believe that.
Part of my conversation with Dudley Flood, an educator who was tasked with desegregating North Carolina schools in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, one of Will Michaels' favorites on the state of things, and we will hear more when our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, spending the hour with State of Things producer Will Michaels, looking back at this past year and talking about some of his favorite conversations. We talked about our Monday Meet series, Will, where we talk with one North Carolinian about his or her life and their work. We had a special Monday conversation earlier this year with Republican U.S. Senator Tom Tillis. Tell us about preparing for that segment.
When members of Congress or elected officials come on the show, here's what usually happens. We get an email saying, well, here's what the senator or here's what the representative would love to talk about. Mm-hmm. Of course, we want to talk about what's happening in Congress right now, so that makes sense, but it doesn't – obviously, we don't limit ourselves to talking about that. Right. He wanted to talk about deregulation in a broad sense, and we knew that that was what he ran on as a platform. One thing that he wanted to talk about, point out, was there are certain federal regulations that call for healthy lunches, quote unquote, and it has to do with nutrient count. But the problem at this particular school that he went to was that they were serving this lunch, this pizza, and kids were throwing it away because it didn't taste good. It might have met federal standards, but it didn't taste good. So his point was, look, we need to deregulate that, allow the school systems to do what they want. But he was also at the state legislature. He was elected to the Senate in last year, 2014, and he was in the legislature when Republicans took over in 2010 and then when they got the governor's mansion in 2012. One thing that has been very controversial, as you know, is talking about abortion regulations in North Carolina. So we said, you know, we know you've been in Washington for, I think at that point, it was about 5 months, but let's bring this deregulation conversation to a broader context and talk about all of these different regulations that were passed while you were in the legislature and while you're in Congress.
Tom Tillis.
That's the thing that's remarkable to me about regulations in general in Washington. We get regulations that seem to work in theory, and we very seldom go back to see if they're actually working in practice. And that's why in every committee meeting that I'm in, when we're talking about some other program, I ask, what sort of baseline metrics did you have pre-regulation, post-regulation? How are you able to track trends to have it serve as any basis for making adjustments over time? But we go through these once-and-done regulatory phases with very little backward reference to, are we actually doing the things that we want done with the program, like improving kids' health?
Now, well, you're talking about regulations, and of course, there's a whole other arena when it comes to regulating the behavior of Americans. As you know, the North Carolina General Assembly recently approved a longer waiting period for women who are seeking abortions. On social issues, where do you draw the line on when and where the federal government should impose regulations on legally authorized procedures like abortion?
Well, I think, you know, I think it varies from subject matter to subject matter. On the life issue, I'm pro-life, and I'm Catholic, and I'm pro-life, and I try to do everything I can to strike the balance between respecting a woman's reproductive rights and recognizing that at some point in time that is a living being that I also have an obligation to protect. So on that issue, there's always going to be that struggle about how to get it right. On other issues, I've made it very clear that the federal government, particularly on the issues that you may be talking about, there are things that are best left to the states. Respect the decisions of states, whether or not you agree with them. We've had this discussion on same-sex marriage. I think that the states should be allowed to make decisions, and I don't believe the federal government should intervene. And I think that in a state like North Carolina, where a purple state, where we're a centrist state on any given issue, people will either be right or left of center, that's a particularly challenging balance that the leadership and the legislature have to face. But it's their job to do that.
Well, you mentioned being a Catholic. We know where the Pope stands on abortion, but the Supreme Court has said that it is a legally authorized procedure. So should even the states be allowed to restrict what the law of the land says is the right of everyone in this country?
Well, I think what you get into is the discussion about the restriction and arguments about whether or not you have the health and the hygiene and best information available for an expectant mother to make a decision. That's really the basis of the discussion, rather than what some have said are outright restrictions. That was said back when there was some discussions about improving the standards for healthcare clinics. People 3-4 years ago said all the clinics would be closed within 12 months. They're all open. In fact, the Department of Health has taken a very prudent approach towards determining whether or not, if any, of the health standards should be improved. So, you know, the problem with these issues, Frank, is people want to polarize the electorate very quickly versus look at the essence of the issue. Can we do things that provide better informed choices, ensure the health and safety of the patient, ensure the health and safety of the child?
Yeah, but there's a kind of a theory behind some of this, too. I mean, you talked about the idea that local school districts might be the best place to figure out what's best for their kids. States have a better perspective on what's happening in their state than the federal government. So when it comes to information about abortion, isn't the woman the one who knows how much time I need to make the decision?
Well, I think that you have to determine whether or not the information's been made available to them. That's, again, the essence of the issue. Are we certain that all the alternatives that a young person, and many of them are very young, not all, have access to that information? And when you consider the upbringing of a disproportionate number of expectant mothers who may be considering such a procedure, then I think you want to make sure that they're making a profound decision. You want to provide the best information to make it available to them. And quite honestly, I think that either side of the equation could only want to limit the information to something that in some cases supports a political agenda as much as the best outcome for the expectant mother.
Well, and that gets back to whether the regulation is tested for the outcome. I mean, if just by expanding the waiting period, we still haven't guaranteed that you've gotten any better information in that 3 days, right? There's no way of knowing whether or not you're better informed at the end.
Well, I think that you can measure at least some outcomes in terms of other options that are pursued. It depends on. I think everything has to come up with a reasonable basis for measurement. But at least in the case of some of the legislation that has passed, it has resulted in some expectant mothers choosing a different course. Now the question is, I guess they would be best to ask the question, why did you make that decision? Why did you make a decision that, statistically speaking, hadn't been made prior to the implementation of new legislation?
That was part of my conversation with Republican U.S. Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina, aired earlier this year on The State of Things. I should point out, Will, you talked about, you know, the struggle we have with getting elected officials on the air. Often they tell us what they want to talk about. A lot of media outlets say, sure, come on in, and that's it. And we push back. And frankly, that's why we don't have as many on, because we don't agree to let you talk only about. And they will. They often just place that restriction and say, he will or she will only talk about this. And you will find these days And I'm old enough to remember when no journalist ever would agree to that. It happens every day. It doesn't happen here, so we rarely get people on the air. And I, hats off to Tom Tillis for saying, I'll talk about whatever you want. I didn't even try to place those kind of restrictions. So got a lot of respect for that, and it was a great conversation. Glad it was one of your picks. So during the summer, we met Robert Brown of High Point, part of our Monday Meet series. He is such a remarkable person. In fact, we had to have him back. It was 2 hours, and we still weren't done with him. Tell us about Robert Brown.
Right. So one of our former producers, Hadi Mawagdi, originally brought on Robert Brown during the summer. He had relationships with Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and several other dignitaries whose full names need not be said, JFK, RFK, MLK. He was so remarkable that in that first hour, we only got to, I think, the 1960s. So we had him back. And the one thing about this, so he's from High Point. We go to Greensboro once a month. We have a live show at the Triad Stage. So we had him back for a Greensboro program. The amazing thing about having a live audience was watching people, how people reacted to him and how they reacted at one certain point when he told a story about a SEAL test boycott in Cleveland. And he had a piece of tape, actually, from Martin Luther King Jr. talking about Robert Brown's role in the SEAL test boycott. It was amazing seeing the faces of the people who were listening to Martin Luther King talk about Robert Brown.
Here is part of the conversation with Robert Brown of High Point.
Dr. King called me one day. I served on his board, his executive committee, and everything, traveled with him. He called me one day from Cleveland. He said, Bob, we have a terrible problem in Cleveland. He said, we are trying to get some blacks in jobs at SEAL Test. They have a large operation in Cleveland. And he said, they won't even talk to us. He said, they won't even talk to us at all. They won't even have a conversation about it. And he said, if you can do anything, I would be very grateful. And I said, Martin, I'll try to do something. And I said, I know the people at A&P, they're one of my clients, and I know that they buy a lot of SEAL test products. And I'll fly to New York and see if there's anything I can do. So I flew to New York, went into the office of the chairman of the board. And he said, well, Bob, what can I do for you? I said, well, you know, we got a problem. I said, we have a potential problem. And the problem was that if Dr. King and those were going to have a massive demonstrations in Ohio against SEAL tests, the only way they could do that is have SEAL test products taken out of the grocery stores. And A&P at the time was the largest grocery chain in the world. And I represented them. And so I just told the chairman of the board, I said, hey, look, you need to have some of our guys to call SEAL tests and see what they're going to do about this problem, because we're not going to take this land now. He said, Bob, I think you're right. He calls one of the guys in, and he goes and calls SEAL tests and tells him what the chairman told him. Now, I told the chairman, I said, he asked me what we should do. I said, we ought to take all of the SEAL test products out of all the stores in Cleveland if they don't cooperate. And when the guy came in, he told his executive, he said, I want you to take, if they don't cooperate, I want you to take all of the SEAL test products out of all the stores in Ohio, not Cleveland, like I told him. And he called SEAL test, and SEAL test broke down immediately. They said, hey, we give, we out of prayer. They want to do anything. So immediately they start calling Dr. King. Now, Dr. King can't get in one word with them. So immediately they start calling him, and all of a sudden the breakthrough is massive all over the country.
And Dr. Martin Luther King was grateful. That's the backstory. Here's what you might have heard on TV that night.
The next day, Mr. A&P was calling on us. And Bob Brown, who is here on our board, and who is a public relations man representing a number of firms, came in. They called him in because he works for A&P also, and they didn't know he worked for us too. Bob Brown sat down with A&P, and they said, now, Mr. Brown, what would you advise us to do? He said, I would advise you to take SEAL test products off of all of your counters. A&P agreed next day not only to take SEAL test products off of the counters in the ghetto, but off of the counters of every store, A&P store in Cleveland, and they said to CLTS, if you don't reach an agreement with SCLC and Operation Breadbasket, we will take CLTS products off of every A&P store in the state of Ohio the next day. The next day, the CLTS people were talking nice. They were very humble. And I am proud to say that I went to Cleveland just last Tuesday, and I sat down with the CLTS people and some 70 ministers from Cleveland, and we signed the agreement. And this effort resulted in a number of jobs which will bring almost $500,000 of new income to the Negro community a year.
There it is. He said, he said to you, Bob, I don't know what you told him, but my phone is ringing off the hook. Look, the story was old. Everybody knew what the problem was. It was in all the papers. Dr. King has been talking about it. Everybody knew the problem was the lack of hiring. What did you tell him? I mean, you said, you know, sort of issued an ultimatum, but again, that should have been clear to those executives. What was it about you and your message that you think turned those executives?
Well, I think it all comes to self-interest. And every major company and small companies involved are stock-owned. I mean, most of them are stock-owned. These are public companies. A&P was a public company. CLTS was a public company. And particularly with the big investors in Wall Street in New York, they don't want to hear anything about taking business away. Now, adding business is all right. But anything that's going to take business away, they're going to be totally against it. They didn't care. And some of them were not integrationists by no means. They weren't looking for integrate everything, anything else. All they wanted to do is make sure that everything was going okay with their money coming in very smoothly. And if anything was going to get in the middle of that, they were going to be against it. And so all of the big businessmen in America understood that. They understood that in spades. And so you had to get that message mm-hmm. out to them. And I think that's how we dealt with a lot of situations in Mississippi, in Alabama, in Georgia. I went to all of the southern states when there were demonstrations, people being killed and everything else. It was a terrible time in America. I don't think most people realize just how difficult it was and how bad things were in many communities around America. It was difficult here in North Carolina, but not like it was in Mississippi and Alabama and some parts of Georgia. I mean, where people were being executed. And I mean, there were many times when I thought maybe they were going to get me because I was being followed and all kinds of stuff, you know, hollered at in different places. But I went on because I just did what my grandmother used to tell me to do. She said, you know, I dare you to trust God and see what happens to you, son.
Part of my conversation with Robert Brown, CEO of BNC International, one of the oldest minority-owned businesses in the U.S., and one of the favorite conversations this year by producer Will Michaels, who's with me today. A unique form of our program that aired last month is a community forum that we held at Full Frame Theater here in Durham with Leadership Triangle about the school-to-prison pipeline. Tell us about that conversation.
So this would probably be classified as a concept show, what we at the State of Things call a concept show. We take one idea, figure out who are the best guests to talk about that particular idea from different points of view, who has actually lived it, who studies it. So that's kind of the basis of a concept show. This was unique because it was a community forum. It was in front of a live audience like we do in Greensboro, and then it became even more unique. We had a Durham educator named Brian Prophet on the program, and we were talking about kind of punitive measures, how that plays a part in the school-to-prison pipeline. And he dropped the mic on us. I mean, not in a bad way, but he just said, I appreciate that, but I got to say something else. So I'll let him talk.
This is Durham teacher Brian Prophet.
I'm glad that we're having the conversation about the school-to-prison pipeline and the impact of race in our schools, but I actually think that just like the ways that we talk about the achievement gap, these conversations need a little bit more context than they currently have. So when we talk about the achievement gap, which is something that, you know, we talk about as a huge problem in our public schools, the differential in achievement on test scores between white students and students of color, in particular black students, right? But we talk about that as though that's a phenomenon that starts and ends at a school and can be fixed at a school. The achievement gap, as far as I can tell, as somebody who studies history, is a 400-year-old problem. And it really begins when African people are enslaved and brought here and exploited for labor, and that phenomenon exists for about 250 years. And then we have a short period of time during Reconstruction when the whole society is organized around providing health care, providing jobs, providing decent housing, providing for good education. And what we see is the achievement gaps shrink very rapidly, and black people go from being enslaved to being running state legislatures in a period of about 10 years because there's a whole society organized around closing that achievement gap. Jim Crow and the reinstatement of white supremacy, of course, closes that, and the achievement gap widens. Right, we get to the 1960s, Jim Crow ends, right? And again, we see an increased investment in healthcare, increased investment in housing, increased investment in jobs, increased investment in education. And what you see for about a 10 or 15 year period is you see what we call the achievement gap shrinking, right? Then we get to the policies of the 70s and 80s, and all those things are abandoned. And what we see again is this rapid widening of the achievement gap. And we have this conversation as though it's something now that schools or individual teachers or individual principals can end on their own when it's a 400-year-old problem. So I think we have to put the school-to-prison pipeline in the same context, right? I think there's lots of different strategies that we can talk about for teachers or principals or school systems, but the reality is at the same time in the 1970s and 80s when these policies shifted, we saw a massive investment in prisons and police, and a massive disinvestment in healthcare, housing, job training, all the kinds of things that we're talking about, and education. So I feel like if we're going to have a conversation about the school-to-prison pipeline, we have to put it in a context of really a 400-year achievement gap between black people in this country and white people in this country, and that the particulars of suspensions and school behavior and these kinds of things have to come in that conversation.
It was part of our community forum that we hosted last month with Leadership Triangle about the school-to-prison pipeline, a program that was one of the favorites of Will Michaels, who is among the producers of The State of Things. And we're talking about his favorites, and we'll talk some more when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, bidding adieu to 2015 as we ready to welcome 2016. But before we do, take one quick look back today with producer Will Michaels. Before the break, we were talking about concept shows, and you chose one of those shows as your favorite. Another one is the Future of Marriage. Tell us about that.
The Supreme Court was just about to issue its ruling on gay marriage nationally, but right before then, it was legalized in North Carolina. There was a circuit court ruling that made it legal. We were using that as kind of the news item to jump off of that and go straight into, okay, but who is getting married? Why are they getting married? When are they getting married? Let's not just talk about this from a gay marriage perspective, but actually look at what could happen in the future based on what's happening now. So we had several experts. We got down to the data, but the Reverend Nancy Petty from Pullen Memorial Baptist Church in Raleigh was also one of our guests. And what struck me about this particular show was when she talked about her own experience. She got married to her partner shortly before coming on our show. She talked about her own experience and why it was different for her when she finally got married as opposed to when she wasn't.
The Reverend Nancy Petty from our program on the future of marriage. Let's listen.
It is ironic that we're having this conversation about the changing role of marriage and it becoming less significant or important in society as my congregation, along with many others in North Carolina and myself, have fought so hard for marriage equality and for the right to marry. And so I was in a relationship for 13 years in which I was not afforded the right in North Carolina to be legally married. And it placed tremendous hardship on that relationship as a couple trying to raise two children, one biological child of my then partner and an adopted child, just trying to make sure that we were legally covered if something happened to our children, that we both could take care of them. We could both visit them in the hospital because we didn't have legal rights that marriage affords to people when you are married and you can, you know, visit in the hospital, stay in the hospital with your partner and your children, your spouse. And so it placed a significant burden on the relationship. And sadly, that 13-year relationship ended in divorce, and tragic. Divorce is just tragic. It really is hard on everyone. But since then, I have been in a relationship for these past 4 or 5 years in which we were, my partner and I now, were legally married on May 3rd, just less than 2 months ago. And it has made a significant difference in the way that that I think I'm seen as a pastor, as a person in society, that I am legally married in this relationship. And I can tell you from personal experience that you feel different. You feel different when the society that you live in legalizes your relationship, recognizes, legitimizes your relationship. And so, you know, if we are going to talk about marriage and have marriage in our society, then it's critical, it's vital for that, for there to be marriage equality. If we're going to talk about marriage, then we have to say this is a right under our Constitution that's afforded to everyone in the 14th Amendment, and that then we talk about it as a right that everybody has. Because I can tell you that when you are trying to be in a relationship and you don't have that legitimacy, particularly when you're trying to raise a family and you have children, it places a burden on the relationship that people don't have when they have those rights. And so I think that's important for us to remember in this conversation, that if we're going to talk about the role of marriage and the role marriage plays in our society, then we have to really think about what it means for everyone to have that opportunity.
That was the Reverend Nancy Petty of Pullen Memorial Baptist Church in Raleigh, part of our program about the future of marriage. And producer Will Michaels is with me talking about his favorite programs from 2015. I guess this illustrates how we can use Voices in North Carolina to talk about a national story, broadening the context so that you can understand it in a deeper way. Your final selection for the best of 2015 comes from a conversation about the rise of women's soccer with two former world champions. What was your favorite part about this?
Well, what wasn't my favorite part about this?
We were just enthralled. We could not bring you down.
This was awesome. No, I was geeking out, obviously, for the first reason was because we had Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow Cohn in the studio with us. They were world champions of soccer from 1991 and 1999 from the World Cup, but also Olympians. So I'm a huge sports fan. I loved the fact that they were so open to coming on the show and open about kind of talking about sort of the gender differences when it comes to men's and women's soccer, how FIFA treats men's and women's soccer differently. I mean, just the payouts, that's part of what they're about to talk about. But one of my favorite parts of doing this was putting together a montage of the 1999 World Cup final between the U.S. and China. It was 0-0. The U.S. won on penalty kicks 5-4, and I sort of gathered all the sound that I could find from 1999 and put it together. That's how this particular clip starts.
In the back of the United States, organization is the key, and the captain, Carla Overbeck, is in the running there. In the midfield, look for Michelle Akers to have a big game, and up top, Mia Hamm, Tiffany Milbert, and Cindy Parlow in their usual combination.
Chastain reversing all the way to Mia Hamm. Hamm brings it down, still on it with the left foot, and the goal!
Here's Milbert, drives it across. Chastain, Parlow, doubleheader, goal, Parlow!
This is a moment in American culture, not just for women's sports, embracing women athletes in this magnitude.
The winner of the 1999 Women's World Cup will be decided on penalty kicks.
July 10th, 1999 probably was a defining moment in not just women's sports history, but sports history.
On the referee's whistle, Hui Lin with a shot and a goal. China's up. So here's Carla Overbeck with only 7 international goals career. Not a good goal scorer, but good on penalty kicks. The shot and the goal. One apiece. Ying will go next. The first starter for China to take a penalty kick.
She had almost a desire to not want to be doing this at all. And I could see it. It was the strangest thing. And I remember thinking, this is the one.
The shot! Save Scurry!
It means that the USA could win the World Cup on this next kick. Chastain will take it. She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game.
I don't know if I can describe this well enough in words, but it was like it happened very quickly, but it was in slow motion.
There it is. Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow Cohen are still with me, giving each other high fives and reliving every moment of those highlights back in 1999. So let me ask you, I mean, pretty exciting game. How important was it when the tournament came to the United States and you were playing in some very big stadiums? Because there was pushback. FIFA didn't think you were going to fill Giant Stadium in the Rose Bowl, right?
That's right. And fortunately, Marla Messing and Donna De Verona had the vision that, you know, if we put this team out there, people will come watch them play. And, you know, we would go every city we went to, we would do promotional tours and we'd do clinics and everything trying to promote the game. And, you know, in the press conference, we would say, yes, you know, people will come watch us play. We're going to fill the stadiums. And after it's over, we're thinking, I hope they come watch us.
But it meant that you were doing the work. You were signing the autographs, running the clinics, all that kind of promotional stuff that really brings people to the stadium.
That's right. And that's what our team, we were so genuine about that. And we knew that to be successful, we had to be that way. But I think we all wanted to be that way. I mean, if we could touch a child's life in a positive way, we were going to do it.
Kind of chicken egg. You talk about the discrepancies. The women's U.S. national team won $2 million for winning. The men won $35 million. You win $8 million. The men won $8 million for being bounced out in the first round. So there's huge disparities in the amount of money that's being spent.
Very much so. And even back when we would make the we'd qualify for the World Cup, the women's team across the world would get nothing, and the men's team would each get $1 million from FIFA.
Just for qualifying.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. That's changing. Do you think now, again, 25 million viewers, you know, many of them tuning in for the first time perhaps, do you expect to see changes, and will that drive the game if we reach parity or closer to parity when it comes to the amount that's spent on women's soccer? Is going to make a difference?
I do. I think especially in developing countries, because they need money to invest into their women's side of the game. And we're seeing how quickly countries that start investing in the women's side, how much they're improving and how quickly they're improving. I mean, all you have to do is look at Japan, look at England, look at France, Germany. I mean, they are improving very quickly. And that's because they've decided to invest in the women's side of the game.
We're taking your questions today. Laura is on the line from Carrboro. Hello, Laura. You have a question for us?
I do. Hi. I'm a mother of a young girl, about four, and I've always thought that soccer would be a fantastic sport to enroll her in. But I've heard some recent debate over what the best age to enroll kids into that kind of sport is, and I was wondering if you had any input.
All right. Thanks, Laura. Good age. Carla?
I started at the age of five, and I think if they show some interest in it, start them, you know, whether it's soccer, basketball, volleyball, any sport. I know, Cindy, you started younger than I did.
Yeah, I started at age three. I played on my older brother's soccer team. So it was very different then. You didn't have U3, U4, U5 at that time, which I think you do now. At that time, it was all U5s were together, then all U7s. So there's a lot more kids playing now, so you can divide it up by age. But I don't think you can start it too young. I think she's fine to start now, and the earlier she starts and if she's having fun with it, run with it.
We've got a number of questions about concussions and soccer, and I wonder if you are concerned about that, and if there's anything that can be done or what parents should know as they're getting their kids ready.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about it. I actually suffer from post-concussion syndrome, had to retire due to post-concussion syndrome stuff. And we are trying to do some things. I'm part of a campaign, Safer Soccer, for no heading under the age of 14. So teaching kids the technique of heading in practice with a lighter ball, but then actually not introducing it in competition until later, because about 30% of concussions in soccer happen during the act of heading, not necessarily heading the ball, but head-to-head collisions, elbow-to-head, falling down, hitting your head on the ground. So delaying that a little bit longer. And then also I'm developing a company called Inver, which is looking to develop an inner ear device to detect impact and rotation.
And looking ahead, again, 25 million viewers, the money's getting a little better. People are watching the game. Are you optimistic? I mean, again, you have to assume that some of the people are watching because the American team was there. So is this are you optimistic about the future for women's soccer, Carla?
I think so. And, you know, because they had so many viewers, and I think I even read a stat that they stayed – three quarters of them stayed 30 minutes after the game had ended. So they wanted to continue to watch the broadcast. I think Fox did a great job, you know, getting all the games on TV. They were live. I got a chance to watch not just the U.S. team, but all the teams play. And that was something that had never happened before. You know, 24 teams were entered in this tournament. And that's the most ever. I think women's soccer is definitely on the upswing. And talking about all the money and everything, I mean, we would have played for free. We love the game. Don't tell the Federation that. But we would have. I mean, we truly love the sport. Yeah. And, you know, we saw kind of what the men were getting and what we were getting. And we were in a good position to kind of, you know, test the Federation and see if we could get paid somewhat equal to what the men were getting.
World champion soccer players Carla Overbeck and Cindy Parlow-Cohn talking about the rise of women's soccer earlier this year on the State of the Union. So I should tell you all that I get a briefing every day. The whole staff sits around in the afternoon, and each of the next day's segments are briefed. Your briefing went on for 7.5 hours. Well, I don't know if you know that. That's I had exactly. every score in women's soccer back to, I think, the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
Well, that part is probably true. It was at least, I think it was about an hour, but I did. But you're right. No, I did go through each and every kick of those penalty kicks and told you, okay, so then it was 1-1 and then 2-1 and then 2-2 and then Bryce Curry stopped a kick. People are going nuts, yes. So I was excited. I couldn't really help it. And you were going on vacation.
Your enthusiasm came through. It was a fine program, and it's okay. All because of your enthusiasm. So that's it, I guess. We're done, huh?
Not quite. So as you know, every morning you come in and you pre-record promos, and it doesn't always go according to plan. You stumble on words sometimes. And frankly, Frank, you just talk about whatever comes into your mind sometimes. So I took the liberty of going back over that sound and compiling it all into another montage for us.
Uh-oh. Let's listen. I'm Frank Stacio. He's the guy who founded HowStuffWorks.com. But we'll take a look at the places in our state where inventors are working and the business-oriented approaches to solving our state's problem. Many people who fall somewhere in between. Like that note. So you thought, is he a man or a woman? We don't know. We'll talk about the latest developments in North Carolina's changing energy. What happened there? Can you guys fix that? Take two upstanding small-town attorneys, add a paranoid crackpot inventor, part freaking farmer, and then you get a thing. Whether marrying young is a good goal, but that's if you reverse it, you want to fix it. That's the tape backwards. Meanwhile, the debate over Confederate monuments continues today at noon on the State of Things. The package raises teacher pay, butt cuts. Meet Marshall Brain tonight at noon, which if you could do, I'm curious about that. Joel saw the connection between food and the environment and says, that's all, folks. Thanks for joining us. Also, a conversation with North Carolina Poet Laureate, Shelley Stevenson. Shelby. Yeah, I was thinking of... Mary Shelley. I'm lying. I'm Frank Stacio. The Patriot Act is set to expire this weekend. Will Congress act to renew it? What? Nerf, nerf, nerf.
Ooh.
Nerf. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, you're supposed to erase this stuff. You're not supposed to save it.
That's only about a quarter of what I brought together. So I would just say that there's much more out there that the public will never hear.
Okay, Will Michaels, producer on The State of Things, been listening to some of his favorite programs and conversations from 2015. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.